The Laura Murphy Show, episode 52.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Attention, Laura Murphy Show listeners. If you want to see Carlos Lara, David Stearns, and myself put on a seminar for the general public, which is based on the material in our new book, The Case for IBC, and you're in the Chicago area, then you're going to want to pay attention. On Saturday, May 19th, 2018, we will be giving such a seminar. For more details, go to ibcseminar.com. Hope to see you there. Greetings, everyone. We have a special episode of the Laura Murphy Show today. So as usual, Carlos and I are continuing with our podcast series devoted to our new book, The Case for IBC, which you can get from thecaseforibc.com. But we're now on chapter four, and this drew on material that was adapted from Nelson Nash's component of the seminar that we were putting on for the public. And so we thought, as a special treat for our listeners, we have with us the world-renowned R. Nelson Nash. And so, Nelson, glad to have you with us for this episode.
Thanks for the invite. Good to be with you.
So as we've been explaining, what we're trying to do in this series is show people, give them a taste to prompt them to whet their appetite so they go out and, of course, buy our new book, The Case for IBC, which all three of us are the co-authors of. And so here, what we want to do beyond that is also just to give some more information for people who have perhaps already read the book and just want to know more about, you know, where did it come from and supplemental information. So along those lines, I mean, you do give some of your background in the chapter, but I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that. And particularly, I think of interest to our listeners who are all fans of Austrian economics, if you could explain the connection to Leonard Reading, The founder of FEE.
Yeah, that happened back during my forestry days in Eastern North Carolina. I got out of the Air Force in 1954. I had 2 years of active duty because of the Korean conflict and because of the fact that I was an ROTC student. Went to work in Eastern North Carolina with the oldest brother in forestry. And I didn't know anything about socialism. I knew inherently something was wrong about it and so forth, but I came face to face with the mental paralysis that was caused by socialism. And I could not believe my eyes. And so I was mouthing off at a social gathering at a home of this radiologist about what I'd run into. And he says, "Sounds like you need to read this book." Went back to his library, got Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. "Read this." In less than 10 days, I've got it back in his hands, and I have two questions. Where you guys been hiding this stuff? And second question is, why'd y'all hide it from me? He says, "This is probably the answer to your problem that you're wrestling with." Well, the more I read, the better it got, because he convinced me to subscribe to the Freeman. And I was particularly drawn to the writings of Leonard E. Reed. And so that's what started it 61 years ago. Now, I met Leonard for the first time, I think it was about 1966. I'd been promoting FEE and the Austrian School of Thought to everybody wherever I went. And by this time, I was in the life insurance business with Equitable of New York. And so we were having a coffee session one morning, a number of the agents. And someone in the crowd says, "Wouldn't it be good to get a guy like that to come lecture to us?" And someone kind of feeling his oats says, "Why don't you call him?" So I got up and called him, and lo and behold, he was in. And so I got acquainted with him on that basis, and we had our first session with him in the spring of 66, I believe it was. And the longer the relationship went on, the closer it got. And so I used to have him down to Birmingham every year to lecture to a group that I'd put together. And so I got to meet a lot of the folks that are pioneers in everything of Austrian economics in USA.
Nelson, this is Carlos.
Yes.
You know, you're making me think of something as I hear you tell that story, you know, because you're going back 60 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we know of Austrian economics today is that way back then, there wasn't a lot of people that were familiar with the Austrian School of Economics.
You talk about a handful, man.
Right. And so it was always interesting to me that when I would read your book, Becoming Your Own Banker, I would put it down and I'd say, you know, only an Austrian could have written this book. But I often wondered how many people really understood what I was saying. Because even though, you know, that was 60 years ago that you became aware of the school, it's been still a slow process of people understanding the Austrian School of Economics. So, but you can't fail to read The Austrian in Becoming Your Own Banker. And so my question to you is that as you were going around the country, talking to people in seminars, did you find the same sort of thing within the audiences that you were speaking to, that they weren't quite familiar with the Austrian school? Or did you find that a lot of the people that attended your seminar seemed to be already from that camp?
The former case was more applicable. Very few folks knew what I was talking about at all. So there had to be some basic explanations as to how mixed up the world is, how the world was completely consumed with Keynesian thought. See, it was through FEE, it was through the Freeman that I became acquainted with Leonard, we just talked about. But my number two man was Clarence Carson. Clarence was a historian here from Alabama. And did his PhD work at Vanderbilt there where you are, Carlos. And but we had a very close relationship, Carson and I did. Well, he wrote this book some time ago called The World in the Grip of an Idea. It made a profound effect on me. It was written serially in the Freeman, one chapter per month until the book was through, and that took a couple of years or so. And so when it came out in hard copy, I got a copy immediately. And I guess I've read the thing three times because that message that he has, how the world is just completely consumed with Keynesian thought. And they're wrong. It's totally wrong. Well, the Chicago School was fairly well known out there, Milton Friedman. But he was a monetarist. And you certainly couldn't call him a free market economist, in my opinion. But only the Austrians have got it right, that it's the perfect explanation of the business cycle, that it's caused by bankers inflating the money supply and such. And so that's what led me to understand that we need to get the banking equation at the you and me level, that we need to teach people how to secede from what's going on out there in the foolish world.
Well, that's interesting, Nelson, because you kind of set me up for what I wanted to ask you is, you know, I think you say in Becoming Your Own Banker that it was the economic crises of the late 70s, early 80s is when you had your epiphany. But before then, like as of the late 1960s, let's say, were you thinking the banking function has been taken over by these entrenched interests that don't have the people's welfare at heart? Or is that not something that occurred to you until much later? So in other words, were you aware of had you articulated the problem in that form and then only later found the solution? Or did it all hit you in one fell swoop?
No, not one fell swoop at all. No, it was a work in progress over a period of time that we all see things a little bit of time that we didn't see before. We build on what information we've had in the past and our understanding of things. And so it evolved at least over a 10-year period. And then I saw very clearly that the solution was learning how to solve the banking function at the Udemy level through dividend pay and whole life insurance. That is a place that cannot inflate the money supply.
Yeah, that also prompts me to ask a question too, Nelson. But being more specific about the things that we wrote together in the case for IBC, and speaking specifically about Chapter 4, where you're laying out a lot of the things that you're beginning to talk about now, one of the most interesting parts of your book that we also mention in the case for IBC is how you begin the book, you know, talking about the flow of money and how important it is, and connecting it to this idea of who winds up controlling that flow. That's a brilliant idea that you start that book out with. And it can only come from, I guess, from the time that the Austrian way of thinking led you to begin to put that together. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I guess the best way to describe it is if it weren't for my study of Austrian economics, becoming your own banker would never have been written. That I had a firm foundation of Austrian thinking that led me to see what was being missed by most people out there, that the banking function is in the hands of the wrong people. And you can insulate yourself from this by simply seceding from what goes on in the world. So it's not an easy one episode explanation that makes all this come together.
Can I ask you, both of you, I'm curious your responses, because you're talking about cash flow here, and something that didn't fully present itself to me until fairly recently was that it takes a sort of entrepreneurial character to really appreciate the importance of cash flow. And I think it's because, and tell me if you guys think this is on track. So number one, do you agree that like business owners tend to get IBC, as it were, more quickly, other things equal, than a salaried employee? And then if you agree with that, is part of the reason that for a business owner that, you know, it's not that just every month or every 2 weeks they get this guaranteed revenue that comes in, boom, and it's predictable and they can count on it, and then they build their budget around that and just make sure, oh, I got to make sure my monthly where, you know, things are variable. And so for the business owner, the importance of cash flow, which is not literally the same thing as income if you're using, you know, an accrual basis or accounting, that is that partly what why you think it may be that business owners tend to get IBC at the drop of a hat, whereas other people it might just take, you know, years and just they can't absorb it?
Well, in all candor, I am of the opinion that a lot of business folks still have a problem big time. That they have a hang up there. My observation when it comes to small business folks is that they don't really know how to run a business.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I put into the Becoming Your Own Banker and to the lectures that I was giving the story of the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And I had been given this seminar for several times to this group in El Paso. And the sponsor to the seminar asked me, why are you telling the story about that grocery store? We're talking about life insurance here. And I said, well, business people don't know how to run a business. Otherwise, why did they steal the peas?
Right.
Could you say, Nelson, of course, in my background, my experience, many of the businesses that I were dealing with were quite large, with, yeah, you know, 400 or 500 employees. And what I found, I did find what Bob is trying to bring out, that, yeah, for them, it wasn't so much profit and loss that was of great importance. It, mm-hmm, was cash flow. But what I realized is that, being that they didn't understand commercial banking and how it worked, there was a great reliance on the commercial banking system for that that cash flow.
Sure.
And that's where the error was. And they hadn't really looked into it deep enough to see that once they attached themselves to the commercial banking system, they had attached themselves to a form of a dialysis machine that they could not get out of. Right. And it was not working in their best interest.
Yeah.
And so perhaps maybe that's a way to blend in what you're trying to bring up, Bob, and what Nelson's trying to say.
Yeah.
Because I would agree with what Nelson is saying. There's a lot of small business owners that certainly don't know, you know, how to run a business.
Yeah. Let me just clarify for our listeners who haven't. So, number one, if you haven't read Becoming Your Own Banker, you need to. Certainly the case for IBC is not a substitute for that. And what Nelson's referring to there is he's got this analogy of a grocery store to get people to think about a business where everyone is a customer of it, right? So everyone has to go to a grocery store. If he had picked a jewelry store and people didn't buy jewelry, then that wouldn't really be relevant. Everyone buys food from a grocery store. And so he was trying to show the concept that if you own your own grocery store and you're stealing the peas out the back door, don't think that's free, that there's an opportunity cost for that. And, you know, that's bad directly. And also because, of course, your employees might see that and then they would get bad habits as well. But it's funny because Nelson, I guess it isn't. I mean, I think we're all commenting on things and saying things that are from our observations, but there's no hard and fast rule about any of this because it's true. Even Carlos, yeah, you'd think bigger businesses would have this, but Nelson, you even talk about in Becoming Your Own Banker how all these big firms rediscovered the concept of opportunity cost and how investing their own capital wasn't free.
Right.
And they were bringing in like, you know, high powered consultants to like show them something that, you know, hadn't been known for centuries. So, you know, I guess with all this stuff, it seems brilliant if it's been forgotten, even though it was, you know, ancient wisdom.
Yeah. They don't know about Mr. Candion 300 years ago. So, but that's the story of mankind. But Carlos, you mentioned there a while ago something that in the seminars that I do. I always show a picture of the globe and point out to the fact that 80% of the Earth's surface is water and how important water is to us, that 75 to 80% of you is water. And we can't live without that stuff, and it's got to flow. If it doesn't flow, we're in deep trouble.
Right.
And so I go on to point out that I had quad bypass 30 years ago. It was done on an emergency basis. I wasn't expecting it at all. Well, blood's got to flow. Otherwise, we're dead. Money has to flow also. But I point out that most folks know so little about the most important business in the world, banking. They're doing the equivalent of living off of a heart-lung machine 35% of the time. And that's absurd. And there's a way out.
Yeah, this is great. This is a great segue because what is in chapter four and I want you to elaborate on now is this, you know, the typical problem, and it, you know, ties into what you're just saying. And leading up to the guys around the water cooler at the office, you know, bragging about the rate of return they're earning on their investments, and yet they're saving so little. So can you just elaborate on that? Because I think that's something that everybody who's, you know, will get, at least in the United States. I can't speak for other cultures, but surely you've really put your finger on the way like the typical macho guy thinks in the United States. And yet, as you point out in your book, it's ludicrous. The game they're playing and by the rules that have been set up, you know, according to the way the gurus describe the problem, and just to show how you're a hamster in a cage, you know, trying to chase this high rate of return on this small fraction of your total wealth.
Well, the truth is, again, that you go right back to what Carlos was getting across, that the world is in the grip of an idea out there that is erroneous, and people end up majoring in the minors. They get fixated on something like high rate of return, and they don't realize that that is a very minor item, that the cash flow there is much greater, and that where is your income flowing to? we have money coming in and we have money going out. That flow has got to be there. But it is going to the wrong direction because we've been made captives of the banking business by all the promotion that they have of ideas. It's almost like there's card tricks out there.
It is. It is like that, Nelson. It really is.
Really? Yes.
Well, you know, that prompts another thing. Obviously, I know you're animate about this. When you speak of the grip, being in the grips of a false idea, of course, referencing there the socialistic, but also being in the grip of bankers, and that is really where the real root problem rests, in a sense, when it comes to the flow of money. Obviously, that it's. It needs to come back to the you and me level, as you keep stressing. Uh-huh. And I remember even here recently, when you were thinking about downsizing from one home to another home, even then it was dawning on you that to take out a loan from a commercial bank, you are actually participating in the problem.
Exactly.
Simply because of what you know of the Austrian school and the inflation of the money supply. So when you say in one of your basic principles of IBC is don't do business with banks, that's what you're getting at.
True. Well, I like the way that you've described it to a number of groups on a number of occasions, that you explained that if you have a loan of any kind, including a mortgage, any banking function of major size there, if you have a loan at one of those places, you're part of the problem. If they don't have customers, they're not in business. And this is so obvious, but people have been trained to be slaves. At fault is our educational system, because it's really not educational, it's indoctrination.
And it's easy to see how we can fall into a pattern like this. You mean, it did take time, you know, for the whole country just to not even think twice about the fact that they're using the banking system, the commercial banking system, as their cash flow system.
Yes.
And that they need to create an alternate bank in order to do it correctly, which is the alternate bank idea that you keep talking about in IBC.
Yeah, and this is the connection, too, for our listeners who haven't read the book Carlson and I did called How Privatized Banking Really Works. So just to refresh your memory, I had been an Austrian economist. I was familiar with the Austrian business cycle and how the commercial banking system can create and destroy money in these cycles that makes interest rates go down and up. And that caused the business cycle. And then independently, Carlos had, you know, introduced me to IBC, and eventually I came around and got over my objections. But I still thought these were two separate things. And then Carlos pointed out, well, no, if every household or business that embraces IBC and, quote, becomes its own banker, that's one fewer entity that's contributing to the inflation problem. Because as Nelson and Carlos are here saying, commercial banks, in order to extend credit and to expand the money supply, they need to have borrowers. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do that. So they can't make loans out of thin air if no one's borrowing the money. So there's that element as well, that this is not only something that makes sense at the individual level, but it actually is good for the rest of society. We're nearing the time we have to start wrapping up here. We've probably got time for one or two more questions. So, Carlos, if you want to think of the last thing you want to ask Nelson, what I want to ask Nelson, because I get these questions all the time, and I'm sure you get them times 10, but people, it seems like everyone is convinced this is a great idea, except it wouldn't work in my circumstances. Either I'm too old, right. So you know, clearly I couldn't take out life insurance on myself, or I have a medical condition, or I'm too young, I don't have enough money right now that it makes sense when I'm 50 and I have a higher income. So can you just talk about, you know, that idea of, you know, is IBC something that only works for a real certain demographic, or what are your thoughts on that topic?
Well, what's happening is that they're bringing to the subject at hand a lot of baggage that is erroneous, and they've got to be able to recognize erroneous information and the obstacle that is presented in their own minds. That's the problem. And so I illustrate it this way. You know, being a forester, I also know something about the plant world big time. And let's talk about an agricultural product like corn. Okay, you got to prepare the soil, and the plows put little mounds there to put the seeds into, and you plant corn. Yes, but the corn comes up, and after a while, you've also got something else that you did not plant. What is that? Weeds. Now, you have a huge crop of weeds to the point where you can hardly see the corn. Now, if you get the weeds out of the way, doesn't the corn stand out like a sore thumb? My point. You see, it's that excess baggage out there. It's the nonsense that has created the problem.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to get their mind readjusted. I keep telling people that infinite banking is all about how you think. It's how you think. And if you try to solve the banking problem with erroneous information, you're not going to win ever. But it's ridiculously simple. That's the mystery of it all to me.
Yeah, if I may ask one additional question here, Nelson, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit it to the audience that's listening that, you know, that it took me so long to understand the concept. And so in one sense, IBC is quite simple. And at the same time, it can be difficult for some people like me to understand. And when I heard you mention the word noise, the noise that's out there,
yes.
When I first came in contact with IBC, that's exactly what was wrong with me. I had been listening to the noise. I've been parroting the noise. I had that Harvard MBA thinking going on in my head. So it was difficult for me to get into and actually practicing IBC.
Yeah.
And so there's always that hurdle that we have even today as you know, being patient with people so they can be properly introduced to IBC and get into practicing it. And what I'm wanting you to speak to is a little bit of that problem, the closed mind, and then, of course, how once they can break through, that if they start thinking long range, intergenerationally, you know, with their families, how powerful the system can become. You talk about that in Chapter 4 quite a bit. Can you speak to those things I've been talking about here?
Well, what we're really doing here is building an aquarium. It's all self-contained. We're building a microcosm that is different from the way that the general world looks at the banking process. We simply use dividend-paying whole life insurance, a place that cannot inflate the money supply, and it's like-minded people that are all involved in this. And so it is an aquarium. It is a microcosm. But that is beyond the comprehension of most folks because they can't get over what they've been taught. Now, this is not a new phenomenon. Good grief. Go back to biblical times there. We all know the story of St. Paul's conversion, that he was the Pharisee of the Pharisees, and he was on the road to Damascus to punish Christians and so forth, and just got the living daylights slapped out of him. It took 14 years of introspection to finally get his brain rewired. Well, if it took him that long, why are we worried about such a short period of time, really? But that's the phenomenon we were really dealing with right there. The world has always been filled with nonsense. There's never been an exception. Learning how to recognize nonsense and discard it is extremely important. And particularly when it comes to something that is intimate as the banking function in life. We just can't live the way we live without it. Someone is going to be the banker, and it's in the hands of the wrong people. Well, if you succeed, look what a wonderful world it is. It is so simple. It is so profitable.
Yeah, I really like that metaphor you're using there, because I know for me that, you know, not to make light of the significance of that analogy, but as an economist, you know, with a degree from NYU, and when I first encountered IBC, I thought, oh, this is clearly wrong. And then later when I came around to seeing it, now I think, you know, I can appreciate it. So like my training actually helps me, because now I can show using those standard tools why it makes sense, you know, and likewise that it was good that Paul had all that background. So he's writing his epistles and he can certainly, you know, place Christian theology in the context of the earlier doctrines.
Yes, well, see, he knew what evil looked like. And that, yeah. So that's what you bring to the table that I'm so pleased with, is that you know what the devil looks like. Get stay away from that ghost, guys.
Nelson giving a plug there for higher academia, of course. Well, we should probably be wrapping up now. We've hit our time limit. So, Nelson, thank you so much for giving us your time and sharing your thoughts. It's always a pleasure to have conversations with you. And we will see all of you next time as Carlson and I continue on this series. We'll be tackling, of course, Chapter 5 next time. This has been Episode 52 of The Laura Murphy Show. And if you haven't yet checked it out, go to thecaseforibc.com. Thanks, everybody.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.